Welcome to this podcast of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton, founder of Climate One. Climate One brings together thought leaders from around the world to advance solutions to global warming. The Commonwealth Club is a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. Join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good day, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Jay Inslee is congressman from the 1st District, 1st Congressional District of the state of Washington, and he is the primary sponsor of a current legislation called the New Apollo Energy Act, and he is a member of the powerful House Energy and Commerce Committee. Congressman Inslee is a native of Washington. He did his degree in economics at University of Washington at a time when the Washington Huskies were defeating Mycal Bears by large margins and often. And so I will suppress my resentment about that. The other speaker, Bracken Hendricks, is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He was a co-founder and executive director of the Apollo Alliance, which you're going to hear more about today. Mr. Hendricks lives in Washington, D.C., and is a graduate of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He worked previously in the Department of Commerce in the Clinton administration and in Al Gore's office during the Clinton administration. So without further ado, we're going to hear first from Congressman Inslee and then from, or is that how you're going to do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Jay Inslee, and it's an absolute delight to join you to talk about Apollo's fire igniting America's clean energy economy. We believe if you want to know about a clean energy revolution, and if you want a shot of optimism and a dose of hope and a good spirit of can-doism, this is a book for you, because Brack and I are here to talk about what we believe is the next great revolution that will be led by America, which is the clean energy revolution. And we were thrilled to write it because we got to know some of the brightest, most optimistic, most spirited Americans in the country, and thank goodness there's a lot of them. And I just want to take a moment to tell you why I'm so pleased to be here on Market Street. My dad served in the Navy during World War II, and he was stationed here, and he fought the Battle of Market Street. And I heard about this all the time and won the Battle of Market Street, because his job was every night going up, one of his jobs, and rounding up all of the sailors who had acted with some discretion on occasion, and throwing them in the back of a truck and rounding them up and getting back on the ships back in the harbor. And he won the Battle of Market Street. So it's good to be back here on Market Street fighting another battle. And this is, if I can jump a little metaphor here, you know, America in World War II was the arsenal of democracy. And we went from making 3,000 airplanes in 1939 to 38,000 airplanes a year in 1943, and we invented hundreds of new technologies during that time, and we really were the arsenal of democracy. And the book Apollo's Fire now basically says that we are about to become the arsenal of clean energy for the world, and that it is America's destiny to lead the world to provide America with the clean energy technologies that are an absolute necessity to prevent our planet from imminent catastrophe. And we believe that is uniquely an American destiny, because this is a perfect challenge of global warming and addiction to Middle Eastern oil, are two twin challenges for the country that are uniquely appropriate for America to solve. And the reason is that if you think about where America shines, it is at moments of technological transition and challenge, because we are, not to be too hubristic about it, we are the most innovative, creative society in the history of humanity, with all due respect to the Egyptians and their pyramids. And so we think that the challenges that we now face with 1 million square miles of the Arctic melting this summer, actually disappearing the size of six Californias. This morning you read in your newspaper about the Wilson Ice Shelf beginning to break up in Antarctica. With coral bleaching, I just left Stanford University with one of the world's leading oceanographers who's told us about the acidification of the oceans, which could eliminate coral reefs in 50 years everywhere in the planet Earth. We know this is a planetary emergency, but there is a group of people standing ready, willing, and able to lead the world in this clean energy revolution. And it really is a worldwide need and a worldwide effort. And this was brought home to me last week when I went to India with your Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, who has been a supremely effective leader in this clean energy revolution. She led us in a delegation to India to look at some of the global warming issues that they're facing and how they're going to deal with it. And we met the Dalai Lama in Dar es Salaam, which was an amazing experience, going up to Dar es Salaam and meeting this world leader in the movement of nonviolence. And when we talked to him, you know, he was right in the middle of this problem of suppression of the Tibetan monks in Tibet. But that's not the only thing he talked about. He talked with us about the challenge of the Tibetan plateau losing its water supplies due to global warming. He talked to us about the glaciers of the Himalayas, which supply the water for 40% of all humanity get their drinking water from the glaciers of the Himalayan mountains. And those glaciers now, they're concerned about receding during global warming. So here you had the Dalai Lama at the moment we had this violence going on amongst his people talking to us about global warming, and that really brought it home to me how international in scope this issue is. And there are 400 million people in India have no access to any electricity and are going to want access to electricity. And if they use coal-fired electricity to get electricity, the planet is essentially doomed. So it brought again to mind to me why this book was kind of timely. Because this book basically, if you read it, will tell you the story and stories of the Americans who in all 50 states are today, at this moment, at their labs and at their businesses and at their universities who are designing the future. And one of whom I'll just mention is Vinod Khosla. Vinod Khosla is a fellow who did well at Sun and now has transitioned into the clean energy economy. And one of the great quotes, we tell the story of Vinod Khosla, who now has an interest in 24 clean energy companies. Now here's a son of India who moved to America, did well. He walked in, we tell the story of him walking into a room in the basement of the Capitol one day several months ago, and he said, first thing he says is, we don't need oil. Now that's a pretty dramatic statement. But he then went on to explain to us his efforts in solar thermal energy and biofuels and solar photovoltaic and a whole host of technologies that he's involved in. There's one story, and I'll tell just a few others. The exciting thing about writing this book is that what we found is that at the very moment of the highest peril of the world, we have Americans who are ready to tackle this job and get it done. And to give you a flavor of what is out there, let me share one day of my life in the last year of writing this book to give you a flavor of what's out there. And this is California-centric, but I'll accept that since I'm in California today. I came down here to talk to a national journalist, environmental journalist convention some time ago, and it was at Stanford. And after we got done with the talk, we thought we'd go around and take a little tour of what's going on in California. So the first thing we did is I talked to folks at the OSRA energy company. OSRA is an energy company. It's one of its large investors, Vinod Khosla. And OSRA has developed a way. They're in Palo Alto. And this is a company that figured out, how can we use the sun's energy even cheaper than photovoltaics? They thought, we've got to be able to use it from a thermal standpoint. So they have gone out and developed a way to use flat panel mirrors to basically, in long rows of mirrors, focus the sun's radiant energy on a pipe of water, heat it up, use the energy of that water to drive a steam turbine and create electricity. Now, here's a technology that some people doubted. In fact, I was talking to a colleague of mine down in California, in Florida. I was trying to get him to vote for my renewable portfolio standard, where we'd have 15% of our energy from clean electricity. And he said, Jay, we can't do that in Florida. We don't have any renewable energy. And I said, well, you know, how about solar energy? He says, no, we can't do solar energy in Florida. We have clouds. We have too many clouds. And I said, man, I thought in your license plate it said the Sunshine State. What is the deal? He said, no, it's just, it doesn't work. Well, interesting, 2 weeks after that conversation, the Astra Energy Company, Palo Alto, California, signed a contract in Florida to provide electricity for about 250,000 homes using this solar thermal technology, and they have now a contract with PG&E for another 300,000 homes in California. So here is it. This is the 9 o'clock adventure, seeing a breakthrough in solar thermal technology. And their genius is, and this doesn't sound like rocket science, but it works, instead of using concave mirrors, they're using flat panel mirrors, and they can make them a lot cheaper, and they believe they can produce electricity that will be competitive with coal-based electricity within the decade. Now, when they can do that, the sky's the limit on producing clean, zero CO2 emitting electricity in the United States, because we get a lot of sunshine, at least in the bottom two-thirds, and it's actually more than you thought. We actually have about 75 or 80%, as much as Northern California and the state of Washington. So you'd be amazed where you can get solar energy. For instance, Germany now is leading the world now. And, you know, Germany, cloudy older Germany, I'm telling you, they have, I think, about 16% of their energy from renewable sources, predominantly solar right now. So we can do it in a lot of different places. So that's 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock, I get on a bus, and I get on the first fuel cell hydrogen bus that has been in standard operation in the United States. It's operated by the transit company in the East Bay. Remind me the name of the East Bay transit company. AC Transit. Okay, so they're operating this bus. We drive up the freeway, and we got all these journalists in the back, and we pull over off the freeway, and the gentleman says, okay, now it's your time to drive, Jay. And I go, you know, fellas, I don't have a license for a bus. We got a bunch of journalists in the back. I don't want to headline Congressman Rex $2 million bus, you know. So I didn't drive it on the freeway. And they said, okay, we'll take it to the parking lot. So I went to the transit company parking lot and drove it. And I'm an old truck driver. I used to drive a cement truck and a dump truck, so I like trucks. And this was a cool machine, quiet, comfortable, no vibrations, no smell, you know, just a wonderful environment. No diesel fumes coming up, you know, in the passenger compartment. I just loved it. Good pickup, you know, very maneuverable, wonderful machine. So I became, and this is what I came here to brag about. I'm going to brag right here. This is my one bragging rights. I became the first member of the United States Congress in American history to drive a hydrogen fuel cell bus, and that's my mark of esteem, and I'm pretty happy about that. And to put this in perspective, 6 months before I was there, George Bush came, and they showed the bus to George Bush. And they told me that they let him sit in the driver's seat, but they did not let him drive. And I, you know, I don't know why that was. I don't know if they were just pesky Democrats or something. I don't know what the problem is. So that's at 10 o'clock. Then at 11 o'clock, we go down, we drive down to Hayward, California, and we go to the Mendel, and I believe it's the bioenergy company, but anyway, it's Mendel, M-E-N-D-E-L. It's named after Gregor Mendel, who we required did the fruit fly experiments and understood genetics. And what Mendel is doing is they are developing the next generation stocks for biofuels, and they're developing plants, basically, that will be much more productive than corn, because as you know, corn is of sort of marginal utility and has some environmental issues. So what they're doing is they're developing the next generation of plants that you can use that will be much more productive and much more environmentally benign. And they've developed a plant called Miscanthus, which is 10 to 12 feet high. It's a relative of sugarcane. And this plant, they believe, will be 3 to 5 times more productive per acre than corn-based ethanol is today, what we're using and producing today. And bonus, that plant uses less fertilizer and less water, so it will reduce the environmental consequences of biofuels. So they're very excited. These are now in test plants across the Midwest to determine how far north this can be grown, but many people who have evaluated this believe that we can have 25% of our transportation liquid fuels by 2030 without using additional land than we're already using, essentially, significantly for biofuels. So as one part, this is not the silver bullet, but it is one potential part of our solution. So then we get Dennett Mendel, and we drove back to Stanford, and at Stanford, I got to meet a guy named Felix Kramer. And Felix Kramer is in our book. He is the first story that we tell. And this book is basically a series of stories. This is not some polemic, you know, that'll just bore you to tears with policy. We wanted to tell the story. So we told the story about Felix Kramer. Felix was a guy who was in the internet business, got out of the internet business, did okay, looked around and said, you know, what's the next big thing? What's America going to do? What do we need? And he said, obviously, we got to electrify the car. This is just obvious to Felix, if it wasn't to Detroit. And he said, why don't we have a transition vehicle before do we get to the full electric car? Let's design a car that will be maybe half electric. We can plug it in at night, run off a battery for 40 miles, and if you want to go more than 40 miles before your next charge, you can run on a hybrid drivetrain like the Toyota Prius. So he goes to Detroit, and he talks to the management of Detroit and says, I want you guys to do this. I can't do this, you know, myself. I need Detroit to do this. And the managers look across their big desks at him, and they say, Felix, that's just fine. Why don't you go back and smoke that cheap stuff in California and put on your hemp shirt or whatever you do in California and just leave us alone in Detroit to, you know, make the cars, and you go back and go surfing or whatever. So he comes back here and he says, look, and they basically tell him it's impossible. And he says, it can't be impossible. We've got to be able to do this. So Felix Kramer goes out on the internet, trolls for some friends, folks who are interested in this subject, and designs a plug-in electric hybrid car over the internet, maybe the first car designed over the internet, builds a plug-in electric car in his garage. We have a picture of him and his buddies. They call themselves the Cal Car. We call them the Cal Car guys. They have a Cal Car organization. And they build a plug-in electric car that basically was a Toyota Prius when they started. And now is a car you plug it in at night with a little cord he calls the dongle, which I'm told is a software term, the dongle, which will now become a ubiquitous term someday. You plug it in at night. You drive 40 miles, all electric, no CO2, fantastic car. Well, that's Felix Kramer of a year and a half ago. Well, guess what happened 2 months in Washington, D.C.? General Motors brought to the Washington, D.C. car show the GM Volt. And the GM Volt, they tell us, will be in mass production as a mass-produced plug-in electric hybrid by 2010, 2011. And the vision that Felix Kramer had in his garage will now become a mass-produced option for America. And I believe, Bracken and I believe, that this is likely to become the transition to the full electric car and will be mass-produced and will be on our roads, saving us enormous amounts of gasoline, because 60% of the normal day, 60% of the normal American day, you drive less than 40 miles. So you'll be using all electric the whole day. And if you do want to go that other 40%, you burn gasoline in a hybrid car, or ultimately cellulosic ethanol, maybe from the miscanthus plant that Mendel's developing, or someday biodiesel, so you can get away all off of gasoline. If you burn gasoline, you get 100 to 130 miles a gallon, and if you burn cellulosic ethanol, you get 500 miles a gallon of gasoline together with the electricity use. And here's a couple bonuses. I just left Stanford, where I was talking to folks who are doing this cutting-edge research at the Institute at Stanford, and they were telling me that you will be able to essentially rent your battery to the utility company, and as you're spinning your wind turbines at night generating electricity, you're pushing electricity into your battery, and you can rent your battery to the utility company. And we've had people testify that have value of $1,000, $2,000. You get a credit from your utility company. And that's a pretty sweet deal to be making money at night with your battery leveling the electric load across the grid. And double, triple bonus, this car, as the grid becomes greener, as the electric grid uses more wind, more solar, more enhanced geothermal, the car will become greener. It will become more environmentally benign over time. Now, there are only two other things I know of that get better with age, other than the plug-in hybrid, and that's wine and my wife, Trudy, who's here today. So thank you, Trudy. And so this is going to be a sweet deal when it happens. So here's just one day of one congressman's life to see the vision of the future that we can have. And that's why it's been so exciting to write this book. Now, there's only one problem with this glorious picture I'm painting. It won't happen totally intuitively or naturally, because right now the system of the market we have is so heavily skewed to the oil and gas industry. There are so many subsidies for the oil and gas industry, and we allow these companies now to put their carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in unlimited amounts for free. Well, as long as those companies have this leg up, these other new investors and new inventors aren't going to be able to really blossom. So that's where we need leadership out of state capitals in Washington, D.C., to fix this broken market system. And we talk in the book about the things that have to happen to give an incentive and to level the playing field so these new technologies can take off. And the single most important thing we need to do is to cap the amount of carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere and charge polluters for the right to put pollution into the atmosphere. And the reason that's necessary is, think about this. We allow people to put up, you know, coal-based utilities to put gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere, this terrible pollutant, in unlimited amounts for free. This is a travesty. We would never, ever allow a utility to take their trash and put it into a dump truck and pull up to Golden Gate Park and dump it in Golden Gate Park for free. We would never allow that. We said, that's insane. You can't use this common asset for your personal dumping ground. But we're allowing these polluters to use the atmosphere as their personal dumping ground right now in unlimited amounts. Well, that has to change, and it's going to change because we are going to pass my bill and a bill that Henry Waxman and Nancy and others are helping with to have a cap-and-trade system that will put a limit on the amount of carbon dioxide that can be put in the atmosphere and tell these companies you have to have a permit and you have to pay for that permit. And that will be sold at auction to get the highest price possible. That money will go into a fund that will then be redistributed to Americans to help them weatherize their homes, help them buy fuel-efficient vehicles, do the research and development that's necessary, and help these companies get off the ground. Now, when we do that, you are going to see that's going to be the first shot fired in this clean energy revolution. That's not all we have to do. We need my renewable portfolio standard bill to pass. We need ultimately our feed-in tariff bill to pass. We need to take back $21 billion of breaks that have been given to the oil and gas companies and give them back to these clean energy companies. We need our bill for fuel efficiency of cars. We need our efficiency lighting standards. Two of those have passed. We have to get off the dime, and America has to stop acting as an ostrich, which we have under this administration for the last 7 years, with our head in the sand and our tail feathers in the air, and start thinking as the American eagle. And I'm here to tell you that when that happens, this country is going to fulfill its destiny as the leader of the clean energy revolution, and we've seen that, and I'm happy to say that this book, if you're interested in the subject, might help you along that path. So with that, I want to turn this over to Bracken Hendricks, who I enjoyed the last year and a half writing this book with. Bracken.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank Carrie Curtis and the Commonwealth Club for having us here. It's really a pleasure. And it has been a real treat over the last year and a half writing this book with Jay, because it was a chance to actually learn what was going on and speak to some pretty remarkable people around the country. But as Jay said, these people can't do it alone. We tell the stories of the technologies that are out there, of the leadership that's going on in communities, of the organized, the entrepreneurship, the political leadership and courage shown by mayors and governors. But without some sort of overarching national vision, without some sort of sense of collective purpose, we really can't rise to the scale of the problem that we're confronting. And as we looked around, we realized, you know, we started telling stories about technology and economics and sort of, and we realized ultimately though what we were doing was writing a book about hope. That in the face of global warming, people often retreat when they're confronted with the magnitude of the problem and the sense of powerlessness. And we felt that the act of storytelling, just as Jay was kind of recounting to you all of these real-world technologies and all of these real-world situations, it's really critical for us to understand what we can do right now. But in the midst of that, it's very difficult to really understand the scale of the problem. So kind of before I dig in, I just want to just underscore the scale of the situation and that we're facing right now. And because we're in a really unique moment. We're in a moment where the status quo is no longer an option. If we proceed on the path that we're on, it will lead us to a climate crisis. And we often talk about, you know, Jay mentioned an area of ice the size, six times the size of the state of California melting last summer, the first time it had ever happened. Sometimes we talk about polar bears stranded on ice floes and starving. But it's remote and it's three steps removed from our daily lives and the sorts of struggles that we're dealing with on a daily basis. I started an organization called the Apollo Alliance, which was designed to kind of deal with some of these political fights because really ultimately solving global warming is not a crisis of science, it's not a crisis of technology, it's not even a crisis of economics, it's a crisis of political will. And we realized that we needed new people fighting for this, fighting for it on their own terms, from their own sense of self-interest. So we reached out to organized labor and brought labor unions and said, you know what, there's jobs here. Solving global warming is about investing in the future of the economy. And we worked with civil rights leaders and we said, you know what, rebuilding to solve global warming means building new transit systems. It means weatherizing homes, rewiring the very places where we live. And there's a tremendous amount of work to be done to make our communities stronger, more vibrant, and more livable. And the whole notion of green jobs and being positioned for the leading edge of the new economy, it was tremendously exciting for members of the civil rights movement and community advocates. So we had the sense of what's possible emerging. But I mentioned the whole question of scale. You know, Jay talked about the loss of drinking water for 40% of the world's population. That's a staggering fact. And we need to kind of put a human face on that. The loss of a rise of 3 degrees temperature means loss of drinking water reliably for 2 billion people around the world. It means a 15 to 35% loss of agricultural yields in Africa because of a loss of soil moisture. You know, Africa is not a continent that can stand to lose 15 to 35% of its productivity. That means 80 million more people suffering malaria as mosquitoes rise into higher elevations. It means 1 to 4 million people actually dying of malnutrition. These are real people with faces, with families. So just as we're trying to tell a story of what it means to rebuild our society, we also need to understand that there's a human face to this. And it actually wasn't driven home to me until as we were working on the book. We were at the very end. We'd written this entire book on global warming, and we needed to go through sort of last-minute checklist of details. And one of the challenges was getting rights for the photographs. And there was a story that we tell about Shishmaref, Alaska, which is a town in the United States that's actually having to relocate right now today because of global warming. And we had a photograph of a house that's fallen into the sea. And it's because the barrier ice is no longer forming in the winters, and it's not protecting them from storm surges and from increasing weather events. And the permafrost is melting, so the foundations of the houses are collapsing. And we said, you know, we have a really grainy photograph and we don't have the rights. You know, is there another way we could get one? And this woman named Lucy Ngweak, who is an Inupiat leader who's been organizing the whole process of the move of this American community, said, hold on, it'll just take us 10 minutes. I'll send my husband out with a digital camera. He'll take a picture and email it to you. And in 10 minutes, we had a picture of this house crumpled in the sea. And it was at that moment that it hit me that this is the story of people in their home communities. It's the story of people's neighbors. It's the story of people's homes and their livelihoods. And that's what we're facing. So I really want to underscore for you that we are at this crossroads. We will face climate crisis if we do nothing. But then the question immediately becomes, if that's the future of inaction, what can be done? And we realized that it really is fundamentally a story of a lack of political will and a lack of leadership and a lack of vision. Because when you start scratching the surface, the future that we can build to solve global warming is tremendously exciting. And the opportunities to rebuild, to create green-collar jobs for the people who need them most, as is being done right now in Oakland. There are training programs for guys who are coming out of prison who are facing really bleak prospects, are learning to install solar panels so that they can have a profession and a decent income and a place in a clean energy economy when they had been denied opportunity in a pollution-based economy. And as we wrote these stories, we realized this is fundamentally about rethinking our communities and rethinking what we want to build. It's really a design problem. And it's a collective design problem that we all have to face together. We tell the story of a town called Gray's Harbor in Washington. And it's a town that was decimated by the controversy around the spotted owl and the loss of logging in the Pacific Northwest. It was structured into the sort of the politics and the culture of the town was the sense that the environment was crushing their economy. It really epitomized this zero-sum game where you have the sense that putting food on your table today or protecting the environment for your children tomorrow are at odds. And what they've realized is something that we tell throughout this book, is that we will have a strong, clean environment and a vibrant, healthy economy, or we will have neither. And in Gray's Harbor, they've realized what their assets were. They have a deep water port. They have rail lines coming in and out. They have access to a whole range of agricultural crops, mustard seed, and a number of other things that can be turned into biodiesel. And now they've got the largest biodiesel plant in North America, and they ship barges of biodiesel down to Seattle where it's mixed and reduces our dependence on oil. We tell the story of a town called Luverne, Minnesota, where the farmers have come together to establish an agricultural collective for the farmers to invest in wind farms. And they're gaining thousands of dollars of revenue back off of the wind, off the electrical energy that they're producing. You're starting to see houses get repainted, and you're starting to see new trucks on Main Street and new farm equipment. And it's actually bringing prosperity back into the community at the foundation. And we tell the story of a man named Baye Adolfo Wilson, who's building a museum of African American history and culture in Newark, New Jersey. And he realized that he wanted his building to teach. He wanted his building to speak to the kids who were coming in to learn about hip-hop and house music. And he realized the best thing he could do for his community was to make it a green building with a green roof and solar panels, and to sort of teach about the place of the community and how it sits within the land. And then he realized that he had this power as a developer. He was investing in potentially 400 units of housing all around this in the poorest neighborhood in Newark. It's called the Bottoms. And he said, when you're at the bottom of Newark, that's really saying something. It's at the bottom of a hill. So he's building all of that affordable housing to be green. And what he realized was that there's a lot of money in the system, and there's nothing stopping us from building it to be green. So he's using the existing affordable housing credits that are out there, the Brownfields redevelopment money, the workforce investment training. He's created another jobs program to teach young men, who are coming out of prison, folks who really need jobs the most, new skills in green building. It's a tremendous, tremendously exciting project. So when you start to understand that at this macro scale, we're facing both tremendous crisis and tremendous opportunity, to build a green economy, to produce 25% of our energy from renewable sources by 2025, it's estimated by the University of Tennessee, it would create $700 billion of new economic activity and 5 million jobs. So on the one hand, we're facing global crisis of untold proportions. On the other hand, we're facing this tremendous economic opportunity. And then when you bring it down to this granular scale in communities and you see what can happen, there's a tremendously exciting opportunity. So to kind of step back and look at global warming just for one more second, there are two scholars from Princeton, New Jersey, two men named Sokoloff and Pakala. And they did this analysis. They said, okay, if we want to stabilize our atmosphere at twice industrial levels of carbon, which is sort of anyone's best guess, but they think that we may avoid the worst impacts of global warming at that level, we need to reduce our carbon emissions by 7 billion tons in the next 50 years. So he just created these wedges. Okay, each billion ton, what does that mean? And he just, the two of them asked that question. What's involved in achieving a billion ton reduction in carbon by 2050? And it means reducing our vehicle miles traveled for all the cars in the planet by one half. And this is at a time when every year over year our vehicle miles traveled are growing. So that means we've got to build new transit systems, new rail alternatives, we need bike paths, we need walkable communities, a whole host of things that need to be done in order to meet that goal. It means achieving 700 times the amount of solar panel installed globally. It's a tremendously daunting challenge, but when we think about some of the companies like NanoSolar, who are developing a thin film process to actually print solar panels, or the Austra company that Jay was talking about, it's a tremendous opportunity to build new industries. We need to increase the energy efficiency of our buildings by 25%, which is a huge task. But those are tremendously important jobs, jobs that can't be outsourced. If you wanted to improve the energy efficiency of this building, you couldn't put it on a barge and send it to some low-wage, low-environmental standard country to have it done in sweatshops and have it sent back to you. You need to invest those dollars in the community. You need to pay skilled workers to wrap your pipes, to swap out your boilers and your heaters, to change your lighting. And then you need to buy those new manufactured products. You need advanced motors, advanced lighting systems. And so there's these sort of ripple effects. As you start to look at these solutions, they spread out. And what seemed like a really daunting challenge is a tremendously exciting opportunity for rebirth. And you realize that greening the economy is no longer some issue off on the side, some box that you check off at best, you know, for corporate social responsibility or maybe to, you know, win the votes of one small constituency. In fact, it's a new lens to look at both the challenges and the opportunity that we face in the coming century. So this really can form a new organizing principle for all of our economic activity. And greening the economy is probably one of the most important and profound challenges that we face for the survival of the planet, because we are on this crossroads, but also for realizing the potential of our economy. So ultimately, when it comes down to it, solving global warming is about investment. It's about what we build and how we build it. I want to just quickly mention a group that's recently formed coming out of the civil rights community called Green for All. And they're organizing around this reconstruction of our communities and reconstruction of our economy so that those who've suffered the worst impacts of the last century's economic development, those who've been left on the sidelines, can be brought in centrally into the reconstruction of a green economy, taking economic justice and looking at it not as a question of what incinerators do we want to fight, but instead looking at it as what opportunities do we want to fight for. So I was at a Green for All meeting. We were sort of starting to pull this coalition together of civil rights leaders and a whole bunch of activists to think about how do we actually build the political will to get this done. And there was a Native American leader named Tom Goldtooth, and he was just talking about the things that in his culture, I believe he's Lakota Sioux, you're trained to be grateful for. And he just held up his hand and he said, "We have thumbs." And I just thought it was tremendously eloquent. We are people who have thumbs, and there is tremendous power in that. So really, we have to ask ourselves, what do we want to do with them? What do we want to build? And that is the central question underlying our book, Apollo's Fire, underlying the challenge that we all face now and going forward, underlying the challenge facing all of our political leaders is, what do we want to build going forward? How do we want to use this power? And there's a quote that I've been drawn to repeatedly recently as I've been sort of thinking about these issues. Jay mentioned talking to the Dalai Lama. This is a quote from Martin Luther King. And I like it because it's coming from the civil rights movement, and I think that's actually a better precedent to look for right now. We have all the science we need. We need to stop asking scientific questions about solving global warming. We need to ask the questions involved in building a movement and in consolidating power and in accelerating change. And so Martin Luther King said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." So we are facing a global crisis of untold proportions. But it's not enough to understand that crisis. We need to understand the society we need to build in its place. And we need to start by telling the stories that help us believe that we can actually achieve this goal, that we can get this work done, because it's urgent that we do. For several years now, scientists have been telling us we have a decade to turn this ship around. So maybe we've got 7-8 years to make the fundamental changes that need to be done, put the policies in place, put these investments in place. But what we're here to tell you in this book is that that's actually a tremendously exciting opportunity. It would be a shame to miss the opportunity of greening our economy. It's not something to shy away from. It's not something to be afraid of. Let me just read you in closing just a couple lines from the end of our book. We talk about how the Apollo astronauts, you know, we build out of the metaphor of leadership of John Kennedy coming before the nation and saying, let's do the impossible. Let's achieve a feat that hasn't even been proven with our engineering research yet. Let's send a man to the moon and return them safely home again in 10 years, which we were able to do in 8 years once we marshaled the public investment, the scientific resources to actually get it done. So we talk about, at the conclusion, we talk about the experience of the astronauts looking out the window and seeing the planet silhouetted against the darkness of space and the responsibility that that created. But we also say that, you know, now we're ready to embark on a new adventure dedicated to caring for the thin tissue of the atmosphere, embracing the blue orb of planet Earth. And our ability to accomplish this feat of achieving energy independence and conquering global warming is intuitive, it's instinctive and immediate, but it's grounded in a sober assessment of the stakes, the opportunities before us. Just after Kennedy made his pronouncement to Congress that America was going to the moon in 10 years, NASA Administrator James Webb turned to his assistant, Bob Gilruth, and with honesty said, "Bob, can we do this?" And Bob's answer was immediate, without a second's hesitation. "Yes, absolutely, we have to." So can we capture Apollo's fire and revolutionize the world of energy? Yes, absolutely, we have to. We're at a moment when the choices are few. We will either build a successful green economy or we will face some very serious consequences. So it's been exciting to see what was possible. And I guess in closing, I just want to mention something. We've been sort of trying to talk more about it because there's a tendency to look for technological fixes and look for a silver bullet when we're trying to solve this. But one of the stories that's really inspiring to us is the story of energy efficiency and actually what it means to just use less and to use things in a different way and to be smart about it. It's this tremendously exciting opportunity. It's the cheapest, it's the cleanest, it's the most readily accessible power that's available to us. And in the discussion of renewable energy, we often talk about distributed power and using solar panels and what it means to actually spread out the source of generation. And I guess in closing, I just want to say that this is about distributed power in terms of how we produce our energy, but it's also about distributed power of another sort. It's about empowering people to change their own lives, to change their communities, to take back their politics, to take back the control of their economy. And it's a tremendously exciting opportunity. So thank you all for coming out with your lunch break. And thanks, Jay, for working with me on this.
My thanks to Bracken Hendricks and Congressman Jay Inslee for their wonderful remarks. And I have to say, having read this book, how wonderful I think that it is. And so in this job that I have here, I've had the opportunity to read many books about environment and climate change and so forth, and hear many speakers, and I've gone to conferences, and I've run meetings like this for several years now. And this book is the single best summation of what the opportunities are in creating a clean economy, a green economy. And so I recommend it to you. And let me tell you just briefly about the structure of the book. The book deals with what is the current technology opportunities in improving cars, the greening of cars, solar electricity, both photovoltaic and solar thermal, wind energy, which is already here and already working well, cellulosic ethanol, even though ethanol has a bad reputation among environmental people. I'll act like David Letterman. Say, we'll bleep that out afterward. They make a case that cellulosic ethanol is, in fact, a very attractive transitional fuel, meshes well with our existing system and so forth. And they even say that coal may be not impossible. And again, the environmentalists, coal is the big bad bogeyman. And so it depends on carbon sequestration. So what it gets down to then is what can we do about it? And in one of the final chapters of the book, they lay out the bare bones of what a national energy policy might be. And it's so I found it kind of thrilling to read that because it looks like realistic, you know. And so my wait a minute, these problems are supposed to be impossible, but they're not, and that's the thrilling part. And so my question first for Congressman Inslee is, what style of leadership will it take in Washington, D.C. to take all of these wonderful grassroots developments, the entrepreneurial developments, the community efforts, and all of these things that are so wonderful, and actually kind of connect them together so that everyone's kind of pointing in the same direction? Will that be mostly White House leadership, congressional leadership? Is it mostly thou shalt do this, thou shalt do that, or is it more based on incentives, that kind of thing?
Be mostly me, actually. It'll be taking care of the problem. But I'll have a little help from various quarters. Serious question, and you know, basically the reason we wrote the book was that I've had years of frustration of people not being willing to encounter the problem of global warming and addiction to Middle Eastern oil. And we haven't talked much about the security aspects of addiction to Middle Eastern oil because I think everyone recognizes them. So, and I asked myself, why were people unwilling to face this issue? And the conclusion I had was that people were afraid. The reason we have not acted on this is people have been afraid that we can't solve this problem. People tend to ignore that which they're not confident they can deal with. They just ignore these problems. So I think an answer to your question is the leadership we need is the type of leadership that would create a vision and create a sense of confidence in the American people. And John F. Kennedy did do this, and as well as any leader has ever done, in the space race, where he created this vision and said, we can do this. And that's the kind of leadership we need. And I think we're going to get it, I believe, this November. And we're going to have someone who can really rally the country to this. And we're also going to have a Congress that will be more willing to accept that and actually move. And we are making great strides on this. I want to give people a sense of hope today about this. Under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, the House of Representatives has actually done something about this already. And there are, you know, the first improvement and auto efficiency standards in 30 years we actually passed, and even George Bush had to sign it into law, the first efficiency for lighting and heating and cooling standards. So we're making great strides. We passed a renewable portfolio standard in the House. We passed a bill that took back these tax breaks from the gas and oil and gave it to clean energy. We're working on this cap and trade system, and I'm here to tell you I believe by next fall, we will, or the fall of 2009, we will have a cap-and-trade law on the books in the United States. So the leadership is coming, and I feel confident about that. So cavalry's on the way.
I hope the leadership, I hope there's a possibility to convince some of the other side before this year and another year goes by. That wasn't really my question. You started to touch on the role of militarism in this whole issue, and I think right now part of the problem is that we've got all these resources going into the military, and all these big companies are making lots of money off this. Do you have any examples of traditional military companies? You know, I know GE is kind of making a big PR push about how green they are, but are there any stories about militaristic companies starting to say, "Hey, we could make money in this other area"?
Sure. Well, there's, I think, two questions underlying what you're saying. First of all, the opportunity for new industrial opportunity is for new industrial investment and transformation of processes is huge. You have major manufacturers like GE, companies like Honeywell and sort of producers of electrical equipment and software engineers, a whole range of folks coming to the challenge of reducing our energy consumption with a very serious commitment. There's another question underlying it, which is also a question of priorities, and this gets to the matter of leadership. We've spent since 9/11 about $500 billion in Iraq. A recent report came out about a week ago that looked at that amount of money and assessed that you could have spent that money to deploy the renewables required globally to reduce the threat of climate change 50% with that amount of money. And then if you compare that to our energy R&D budget, we're spending about $3.5 billion a year on energy R&D. When we launched the Apollo project, it was about 6 or 7 times that amount was spent on achieving that goal. If you actually look at the investments on the Apollo project at the time when we undertook it, compare it to the size of the economy, which was then about $600 billion, it was about 0.5% of the GDP. If we were to spend that now in an economy that's $13 trillion, it would equal $76 billion of spending. That's the kind of investment that we need, and this really is about investing. Jay was talking about cap and trade. Pricing carbon and fixing the markets is really critical, but there's also a whole investment side. And when it comes to what's going to actually move large industry, I think it's really important to recognize the important role of policy, because you can go all the way back to the Louisiana Purchase, where Thomas Jefferson decided to make an investment in the foundation of the American economy, through the canals and the railroads and the highway system, to the Apollo Project, to the reconstruction and the Marshall Plan, and to the creation of the semiconductor industry and the telecommunications revolution. All of these were places where smart, visionary public leadership and sound public investments created the enabling condition for huge explosions of economic and entrepreneurial activity. And we sometimes get that reversed, and we think that entrepreneurship is going to, on its own, be able to do this. But it's not without the enabling conditions of smart leadership in a good direction. So I would say that when we get the type of political leadership that we need, it will enable all of the sort of large industrial manufacturing companies to enter into this space, because the size of the market for clean energy is tremendous.
Take a look at Boeing. Boeing, I just met a guy at Google yesterday. The brother of the founder of Google is working in a company called Solar Focus using a photovoltaic built by Spectra Labs, which is a Boeing subdivision now, which is the most energy efficient, most efficient photovoltaic cell in the world. Boeing also just had built the plane and the 747 that used a biofuel made in the state of Washington for the first jet ever to operate on biofuels with Richard Branson's Virgin Air a couple weekends ago. The question is, how soon or whether or not the Bush administration is going to listen to these companies, because these companies are now starting to beat on the White House door saying, wake up, President Bush. We need these policies for economic development, not just green. There's two kinds of greens here. Now, that is a hard nut to crack. And if you want to know what it's like to talk to George Bush about energy, you can read about it in our book. It's kind of a dark comedy. So whether that'll happen during his administration, I don't know. But it's highly likely to happen shortly thereafter.
Thanks for your very inspiring talks this noon. It seems to me that one of the big impediments to going forward is the big energy companies. How do you envision either getting them out of the way or getting them on board? And won't they maybe try to acquire the clean energy companies, just sort of put them in their bailiwick and then either do something with them?
I know that is certainly a legend all of us have, that the reason that this has not happened. And in our research, I really did not come across cases where that has happened. momentum and fear are our biggest challenges rather than that particular phenomena. You actually see some of the larger energy companies starting to diversify. Shell has made very significant investments in some of these renewable energy companies. British Petroleum has made some significant investments. By the way, British Petroleum, George Bush says you can't meet Kyoto targets, the CO2 emissions. British Petroleum met their Kyoto, quote, Kyoto targets as if they were a nation in 2 years and made $300 million by saving energy doing it. Don't tell us that this cannot be done. So you're seeing some of these energy companies to diversify. I was in India last week and talked to their largest energy company. They are actually doing energy research in solar thermal, and we're aware of some of the U.S. companies that I've just listed. So you're getting some of these companies, but there are a couple companies with their heads in the sand that are never going to get it, and you're just going to have to ignore them and put them in the Smithsonian Institute with the rest of the dinosaurs, and we're going to get around them.
And let me just add to that. I agree with Jay on what he just said, but I do think that it's been too hard to move the solutions that we need to move, and that we have vested interests who are fighting actively and are very well organized and very well mobilized. I'm thinking of the American Petroleum Institute, for example, fighting to keep us producing more oil and can keep us relying on oil as the lifeblood of our economy. And then I think about how difficult it was to collect the votes that we needed for some very simple tax incentives for renewable energy in the last energy bill, and the renewables provisions ended up falling out of the bill. And I think that this, again, is a question about building power, and it's a question of organizing and understanding interests. And I think we really need to mobilize the interest in a clean energy economy and find those allies who could participate in a renewable and efficient clean energy economy and to build that as a political base.
I'd like to remind our audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speakers are Congressman Jay Inslee and Bracken Hendricks, speaking about building a new clean energy economy.
In the great book, Apollo's Fire. Thank you.
I wanted to ask, you talked, both of you, about leadership and a little bit about American hubris. There is this sense of being a can-do country. There's also a sense of a sort of an entitlement country where we can use as much as we want and we can have a fleet of Hummers if, you know. But so I guess it's a sort of a double-barreled question. One is, how do we shift that sort of I can have what I want now mentality of Americans? And the other is that this is a problem that's not going to be solved just within the confines of this country. It's a global problem, and China and India and other developing economies feel like, you know, it's their turn to build their industries and so forth. How do we effectively bring them along? Because if we don't, it seems like whatever we do here is kind of going to go up in smoke.
Really important question. First, a cultural question. Second, an international agreement. First, on the culture part. First off, I think we should think about this: the realization we can change. I mean, look at recycling. Who recycled 30 years ago, right? Now it's culturally an expectation. And if you don't recycle, your kid will shoot you, right? I mean, it's part of the culture, and the culture of seatbelts has changed, and the culture of smoking has changed. We have plenty of situations where our culture has changed to help change our individual behavior through the culture changing. And that is what we're going to have to do. Now, how do you do that? Let me first suggest that we have a lot of leaders in this room. We are all leaders in our own communities, in our own families, in our own businesses. And I would suggest maybe one of the more important pages in our book is, I think, page 63, where we quote Mahatma Gandhi, who said, you must become the change you seek in the world. And all of us have some individual role of changing our little small communities we live in this regard. So finding a way to, in our own homes, reduce the amount of energy we use in an efficient way. And, you know, my wife and I stuffed insulation underneath our floorboards over Christmas break. Small thing. We drive a fuel-efficient car. We walk when we can. You know, we keep the water heater insulated. We do these small things that over time, you know, we take bags. I know this sounds like a small thing, but this is actually an important thing. We take bags to the grocery store instead of it's not paper or plastic. We carry our own bags, and we just use the same bag, right? Simple thing. Did we ever think about that 5 years ago? No. But things change. So I just suggest we are capable of changing our culture. The international issue is very, very daunting. When you spend a week like I did with Nancy Pelosi in Mumbai and in New Delhi and see these people, 400 million people in India have no electricity, zero electricity. Those people desperately want access to electricity. And if they get it through coal-fired burning power plants, we're all doomed no matter what we do in the United States. So finding a way to engage India is a great challenge. Now, we had discussions with the Prime Minister Singh of India and Minister Saran of the Minister of Environment, and neither of one of those gentlemen rushed into saying we will accept an international treaty where we limit our carbon dioxide emissions. What Prime Minister Singh said, however, though, I am telling you we will limit our carbon dioxide emissions per capita to the world's average, okay, to the world's average. And he says, I've already made that commitment to you. The problem is if India goes to the world average, the planet's doomed, okay? So we need something better than that. The language we're talking about is that the world, the developing world and the developed world ought to have common but differentiated responsibilities. That's the language you're going to hear talk about, common but differentiated responsibilities. What that means is, to me, is we got to act first, the developed world. It's our moral responsibility to do that, number one. Number two, that we should embrace the developed world, very firm restrictions on our carbon dioxide emissions that go down over time, and that the developed world's obligations, which I hope to get them to, is some obligations regarding standards of behavior so that they can accept standards of mileage efficiency, standards of the type of plants that you have, and then some commitments about what they commit to research and development out of their own economies. Those are two commitments I think the developing world ought to be able to agree to, but we're just starting that discussion and hope we're going to succeed.
Can I just add on with just two very small points? This is intentionally a book about the United States, and for two reasons. First, the United States uses 25% of the world's energy and produces the lion's share of the world's greenhouse gases and is less than 5% of the world's population. Our impact is staggering, and we are indispensable in any solution. And secondly, I think Jay has a story where he was confronted by Well, I'll let Jay tell his story. But let me.
If you can remind me what it was. I can't remember.
It was the one from the U.S. Conference of Mayors about.
Oh yeah.
sorry. The second point, and I can be like Jay Leno. You can just cut that bit out. The second point is that until the United States is ready to act, we can't expect China and India to take action. And I think that implicit in the statement of the Prime Minister of India to Jay was that we're not going to step forward and take bold and aggressive action until we know that there is a real commitment to the justice principle of dealing with per capita emission reductions, and that there is a commitment to actually taking responsibility for making these changes. So your point is a very good one, but the change has to come by changing what's going on in the United States. So we try and call on what we think are very, very proud and honorable traditions about sort of American, the sort of America's myth about itself, about our ability to use technology, to use innovation, to rise to challenges and master problems, and to apply that to actually taking responsibility.
We didn't wait till China developed democracy for us to do it. We are the world's leaders, and we're going to accept this obligation to lead. It is both a moral and an economic imperative, and we are going to do it.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speakers have been Congressman Jay Inslee and Bracken Hendricks talking about their new book, Apollo's Fire. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, observing its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.